Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu Pod of Rock, eurem Podcast-Magazin rund um Metal, Rock und allem drumherum. Präsentiert von EMP. Wir drehen den Verstärker für euch auf 11, und zwar jede Woche. Und jetzt viel Spaß mit einer neuen Episode Pod of Rock und eurem Host Josef Lex.
Welcome, the lovely, wonderful, great and inspiring Danny Phil.
Well, build up. I don't think I can match that.
You haven't heard the intro. I'm gushing 10 minutes about the new album and you. Also, the album, the people out there, unfortunately, have not had the chance to hear yet, but I did.
Cool. All good, I hope.
It's absolutely brilliant. The first thing that jumps into my mind when looking at the album cover is, of course, the title, "The Scream of the Valkyries." Valkyries screaming are usually a sign of the apocalypse of Ragnarok, of the world coming to an end. How did you come up with the title, and how does it inform the rest of the songs?
The album begins on a very positive note with "To Live Deliciously," which is obviously like a mantra for free will and indulging in everything, using the sort of maxim that everything is permitted and life is too short, etc., etc., under a kind of dark blanket, if you will. But the album ends on it's a dark note, because in the song "When Misery Was a Stranger," you're in the position that whatever the cataclysmic event has unfurled, it's happened, you know, whether it's atomic war or whatever, some other cataclysmic disaster. And there is a glimmer of hope, because obviously it's just lyrics and it hasn't happened in real life. But the title was gleaned from the fact that I read that as a world population, we're literally a few seconds away from midnight on the doomsday clock now. Probably further with the inauguration of Trump. The way I thought, not only one, that line is in the song, two, it's a great heavy metal title, but three, it is symbolic of this, as you mentioned, cataclysmic event. Like if you were to see a tidal wave at 100 meters high and you're on the beach, it's the final moment, you know, it's all over. The same as if you were to see the burst of an atom bomb, or if you would hear metaphorically the screaming from on high of the last bastions of our defense before reaching heaven, you would know that's the end of everything. It would be like this horrifying realization. And of course, I'm speaking metaphorically, but technically and mythologically, if you heard the screaming of the Valkyries, it would be like a grim portent that the enemies of Asgard had overrun, and it was indeed Ragnarok. Whether that's a great renewal and a rebirth, or just the end of everything, that's disputed, but that's the meaning behind the title.
After hearing the screaming of the Valkyries, after the cataclysmic event happened, what kind of world would Danny Filth wish for? What would be the ideal?
I'm quite happy with the world as it is, to be honest, without all the, the threats to world peace and the obvious suffering and, you know, everything that's the climate change that's gone completely unheeded. In fact, even more so now, you know, since the climate pledge happened, we've had countless wars and countless, you know, oil refineries set on fire and missiles launched and et cetera, et cetera. And now with this sort of Trump going back on, you know, reversing, you know, drilling and wind farms and shit like this. It's just, yeah, it does seem like without all that, I'm quite happy where I am. I'm a big Victorian fan, you know, I love Victoriana, but even so, I couldn't imagine living in the Victorian era. I'm quite happy. I was destined to be here right now. And post-cataclysmic world would be hideous, wouldn't it? I read a book recently. It was a Times bestseller. It's called Nuclear War, A Scenario. And most shocking book I've ever read. Basically, a story that is a virtual story that has been gleaned from her interviewing like 600 plus people involved in firing the weapons, being first contact in dozens of nuclear bases, and yeah, just everyone from the Pentagon down to just the guy in Siberia who monitors the screen to make sure nuclear weapons aren't being targeted on Russia from over the, you know, the North Pole. So if, yeah, what a terrifying book. So I wouldn't wish that on anybody. And the aftermath of nuclear war is almost as horrific as the initial attack.
This last segment throws a lot of questions aside I had for the interview, because I really find that that this specific talking point gives me leeway to ask you about one specific thing that I'm not very sure I could ask under other circumstances within this conversation. You're a big fan of horror media in general. I've seen you wearing a Tales from the Crypt t-shirt. You're in a metal band that always plays with the imagery of horror. You've got a lot of Clive Barker sprinkled in there. The concept of horror can the ideas of authors ever get to the level of the human indecencies that people in the actual reality produce? Is there anything as horrific in horror books that would topple the kinds of things that humans actually do?
Well, I think most things are based on human instinct and emotion anyway. So unless you can put yourself out of that sphere of belief and understanding, then cosmic horror, Lovecraft, etc. Yeah, but I mean, I guess it's relative, isn't it? We understand the full horror. Like the medieval ages, it just seems to be a very dark period full of torture and witchcraft, which essentially it wasn't. But that's what we take from it. Yeah, I guess torture is still going on. Look at Syria and the unearthing of what's been going on over there. Yeah, I guess escapism is what heavy metal is all about. And essentially, at the end of the day, even if we are influenced by outside influences, so everyday occurrences, which you can't help be, at the end of the day, we're still a band that promotes escapism. That's the whole thing that attracted me to heavy metal. That's why we indulge ourselves with laboriously working on album covers, on videos, on stage presentation, on the music itself, which is of paramount importance. And yeah, at the end of the day, I think people just, they understand human experience, they've read about human experience and the worst of it, and that they can relate to that. I mean, you can't relate to a conflict of interest and people being tortured on another planet with a different, you know, ecosystem and different language and everything. You just won't be able to relate to it because you've never experienced it. So I think that's why human horror is probably the scariest. And cataclysmic horror, you know, invasion from the stars, etc., you know, big world events, hell rising to the surface, etc., etc. That's why I think people relate. But again, as I stress, it's all about escapism. And you'll find a few songs about vampirism on the album, as well as more escapist themes. obviously dabbling in the occult, sex and death, ritualization, you know, usual fun stuff.
You were talking about the human experience just right now. And in an earlier interview, I don't know if it was with Noisy or with Vice that I read, you talked about your experiences with artificial intelligence. Can artificial intelligence, under any circumstance, emulate human experience with enough quality?
I don't, probably, yeah, because I think the premise of AI is to replicate. So it would be taking millions of tiny little influences and building something new from it, which I guess is what, you know, new musicians, new authors, new anything strive to do, because they've, you know, they're on a long list of people that have previously, you know, entered this agreement and have worked in the subject matter. So yeah, I mean, the thing it lacks is soul. And I did read something funny the other day. It was a meme, and some woman was railing about, she said, AI, what the fuck? I mean, my idea of AI is for artificial intelligence to be doing all my housework, do the dishes, wash the car, take the dog for a walk. So I've got time to indulge in my art, not the other fucking way around. AI comes and does all the art, and then, you know, I'm just left to the dishes. And the point of that is that at the moment, it's easy for AI to imitate art because it's almost like a two-dimensional thing. It's not until it becomes, which it has, which you know it has. If AI is readily available, it's been weaponized for at least 10 years. You know, it's gone to the military long before any of us have any inkling of its existence. And I know a couple of people who really, really strong coders. One had to come down the other day because when I upgraded my Mac, it lost fucking loads of my poetry and we never found it. It was just a fucking upgrade bug. Just lost one of my folders. I was gutted. And this guy works for a big company, earns fucking fortune, like 20 grand a month. Between him and someone else, the other guy I know, he a few years back showed me a piece of software that could build an album within 24 hours just by giving them a list of ingredients. Like, I want Dave Lombardo on drums. I want it to have the tinge of Emperor. You know, you could put all these things in it and make you an album. Admittedly, the album, again, didn't have any soul. And you just go, yeah, it sounds like, yeah, yeah. But it was good and it was legible. But yeah, until it actually has a brainstem and the ability to, you know, walk around, then people are going to start moaning when, you know, like physical jobs are being attacked, you know, building, labor, shop stall assistants, et cetera, et cetera.
I think we're ready to get back to the more lighthearted questions.
Me too. Yeah, what the fuck? Worst issue.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I deep dove a whole lot at the start of the interview. There's rumors that you've got gifts in form of teeth, first editions of Dracula, and much more weird and crazy things. But what was the emotional, most impactful gift you've ever received?
The gift of love.
Oh.
Probably true, actually. I don't know. I've had lots of weird and wonderful stuff. And my house is a museum. And I have an attic. And if you go in there, that's like a continuation of the museum. It's like the stuff that won't fit in the rest of the house. And I don't know. I've had all kinds of cool and wonderful things, from pieces of, like, people's ashes. Animal skeletons and collectibles. Like, somebody gave me this massive, like, collectible thing. It was worth about $1,000. Actually, it cost me more to ship it back from America, but I was still pleased to get it. Somebody gave us their their fake prosthetic leg. I mean, I don't even know if they intended to give it to us. It came up on stage. I don't know, some of them, but the gift of love.
The gift of love and prosthetic legs.
And prosthetic legs. The two go literally hand in hand.
If you would have to walk up to your movie shelf and grab a movie that inspired you the most, which movie would you grab out of your shelf? And what is it about without telling the title?
That an evil empire and a beautiful princess. Well, the thing is, I had a friend round the other day and he was marveling at my DVD collection. And then he turned around to me and literally said, well, this is all fucking redundant, isn't it? And I went, yeah, isn't it? I mean, there are some films I have that are just not available. But they're fewer and far between. And yeah, sorry, you just struck a chord then when you said go up to your DVD collection, because literally it's redundant now because there's so many streaming platforms. Fortunately, I was still, and there are still, there's still the need to purchase CDs and you can still buy them. However, that being said, it's becoming less and less. I've noticed some bands. There's a band I love called, very typo, called Domin, just done a new album. Not released on CD. There was a film I was really into the other day, massive movie, and I thought, oh my God, I must buy the soundtrack for that. It's huge. I love it. No, only available on digital platforms. I was like, what the fuck? So even now it's being phased out. So, and I'm, you know, I'm born of the time and I like supporting the artist and I like physical product, even though my partner is obviously hating it because, yeah, the house is getting smaller and smaller just by definition of more and more albums.
And I think it's very funny. The physical medium now is the luxury item. If you buy a CD, there's rarely the option to buy the regular album and the alternative.
Well, that's why we put our foot down on this record, because we were like, no, we don't want... Last time, we delivered 14 minutes, I think it was, or 16 minutes of extra track, two more songs. And people were like, oh, I love the album, but it was just a bit long. If they'd only not had two songs on there. I said, yeah, because you bought the special edition. And of course, I don't blame you. Using Amazon as an example, or play.com or whatever, both products are out at the same time. And one has extended artwork and has a longer playing time. You get two extra songs and it's only a couple of euros difference in price. You're obviously going to go for that, which kind of renders the original one obsolete. So this time we were like, no, fuck it. We're going to be like Van Halen in the 80s. No, this is what we did. Eight songs, actually nine. No intro, no outro, no, you know, halftime Super Bowl, you know, adverts. Just what it says on the tin. And we're happy with that. I mean, it's no short album by any means, but that's it. That's what you get.
That's a very, I think it's a very wholesome idea of completeness, doing the thing and the thing being the thing, not the thing and...
Well, yeah, I mean, it was always the years of, you've got to have, write the album, you also got to think about, oh, you need an extra track for the special edition in Australia. Japan always wants two and they've got to have something that nobody else has got. And you find yourself, you know, like... Why am I doing this? This isn't what we were doing for the album. The album is this, especially if it's like a concept album as well. You don't want to dilute the concept by having a, you know, making of, and, you know, here's a couple of demos from the making of said album and a couple of cover versions have got nothing to do with the album.
What was the first horror movie that you've ever rented or bought, and on what medium was that thing on?
It was if you count the making of Thriller, that was the thing that got me into, because John Landis produced directed thriller by Michael Jackson. John Landis, obviously, American Werewolf in London. So it showed clips of that on the making of Thriller. So I asked my dad, begged him, because he would take video. I'd gravitated from monster movies to the Monday night horror movies, but I wasn't allowed to stay up and watch them. But he'd video them, and I could watch them whenever, which I did. But this time I gravitated towards, I want to see this film, and it looked brutal. And I was like, yeah. And of course, American Werewolf in London is supposed to be a black comedy, and there's some moments in it where you evidently supposed to be scary, but darkly comedic. But as a 12 year old kid, no, didn't register. I was terrified. And I watched it when everybody was out of the house and it was winter. And I remember when they came back, my dad slid the car up without having the engine running and then proceeded to go round the house, scratching at the windows. And honestly, I was so scared. There were like little scenes in that film that, like when he wakes up when he's having all the weird dreams, wakes up in the forest and he's like, ah. And then there's a bit where like the Nazi werewolves break into the house and kill the whole family. And yeah, it was just brutal. I was like horrified. And from that moment on, I was hooked. That was it. I want to be that scared again. So yeah, that was the first thing that I would say. That was the definite switch, was because I'd seen, all the Universal horrors. I've seen Hammer Horror before that, but that was the first one, that and Alien, where it really carried that deep, dark, malignant punch, you know?
We've seen horror films, we've read horror books, we've listened to horror heavy metal. What is the conceptual realm of art that you found horror within that you wouldn't, that you thought of before as a medium for horror?
Well, that's a good point. I suppose getting the train to London is pretty horrific. They do these rail replacements at the weekend. It takes you fucking forever. Travel, getting anywhere nowadays in rush hour. That's the plumbing the depths of horror.
It is. It's pure stress. It's other people. Horror is other people. So,
absolutely.
For my last question, if you imagine yourself on a rainy day on your couch, a rainy day on your couch where you don't have to do interviews with guys like me, what book do you gravitate to?
What book?
Or what book series, or what author?
What author? I don't know, probably an H.P. Lovecraft alike. There's lots of people that do his work very well. Graham Masterton and, there's a load of people. Which obviously now that I'm trying to think of them, aren't actually jumping to mind. But trust me, there's loads in the Lovecraft school of thought. I just can't think of them all. Someone of that ilk. Something a bit more fantastic. I like cosmic horror. I like the settings for it all. I love how Lovecraft always set it in some isolated, like Midian-esque places like Dunwich or Miskatonic, like Miskatonic University and all these places in New England. So we have a place very close to us called Dunwich, and it was actually at one point a major hub on the British coast for the importation of like wool and, stuff coming away from the continent. And then one night about 200 years ago, 250 years ago, there was a terrible storm and a lot of this huge, and it had like 3, 4, 5, maybe even 8, I can't remember how many, but churches. Only one remains now. The rest just fell into the sea. And I was convinced for ages that the Dunwich Horror was about that, because there's all these myths about mermen and some of these churches, you can hear them, in the midst of the night, the bells tolling in the depths of the sea. And a lot of it being, is set in New England. It's just really reminiscent of where I'm from. Even like the webbed feet of the people. I'm sure there's some of those around these parts because I live in a very rural part of England. So that always fascinates me. Yeah, and it can be truly gothic as well. It's not just, you know, cosmic. So yeah, I'd probably gravitate to something like that. I'd love to list all the other people, but this all totally slipped out of my mind, to be honest. August Aleph. That's one off the top of my head. So anyway, yes.
There just rolled another question into my mind that I have to ask you. Watching the music video for Malignant Perfection, I've seen a video that is an absolute love letter to old school horror films, to the vibe of Halloween that one might have as a child. What was the inspiration for that video in particular?
Well, that song in particular, I didn't fight tooth and nail, but I really did hassle the record company to get the release dragged forward so it would coincide with Halloween. It just made perfect sense. And also the song was inspired by the fact that I really do have Halloween playlist, and most of the songs on there name check the celebration, or the song is called Halloween. So I guess I wanted to be part of that party. A Christmas song for Cradlefield would just be very contrived and silly. But the video, yeah, was mainly trying to evoke the feeling of that season, that dark magic. We've actually done a video for Too Live. Did I tell you this? I can't remember. I've done so many interviews. Too Live Deliciously came out 2 weeks ago, but it didn't come with a video because we were busy filming. It was being filmed in LA and the fires happened. There was a big delay. They couldn't get back to filming after fumigation, etc., to a couple of weeks ago. So that video is coming out tomorrow. And it's a bit more horrific, a bit simpler, more horrific. It's probably going to have to carry a censorship mark on it. But it's in the same school of thought. It's horror. Yeah, and I'm particularly proud of that first one. We worked with Vicente Cordero again, and Missy Munster was responsible for all the amazing costumes. She's just a godsend to us, and both of those people worked on the new video as well. We're mixing it up for the third video for White Hellebore, which comes out the week of the album release, which is March the 21st, I believe. But for now, pure horror.
Danny, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
I would love to talk to you for the next 42 hours straight.
Yeah.
Because I think we've got a lot of topics that touch our hearts simultaneously. But unfortunately, we have to put the cut marker right here. It's been lovely to talk to you. And you out there, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and most importantly, rock and roll.
Awesome.
Das war Pod of Rock, euer Podcast-Magazin rund um Metal, Rock und allem drumherum. Präsentiert von EMP. Und für Musik auf den Augen, werft doch einen akustisch formulierten Blick auf emp.de. Mit dem Code Pod of Rock erhaltet ihr satte Rabatte auf eure EMP-Bestellung und unterstützt so unseren Podcast.